Silence is their answer, the 1% is clear. If we organize for justice, they respond in riot gear. 99 want health care for all and for all to go to school. Not poisons in our country driven by military rule.
From Colorado and today, Washington, D.C., welcome to the Tim Danahy Show here at Danahy.com. And today's show takes a break from our usual government issues and economics and world affairs, sort of. We're going to have a conversation with an author about his new book. But before I tell you the name of the author or the book, let me make a personal comment about it. As regular listeners know, I read the books for the authors who come on the show. It's a common courtesy. If the author is gracious enough to come on the show, they deserve a conversation where the host is engaged with the subject. And my library has hundreds, maybe even thousands of books. And today's book is one of the most important books I've read in recent years. It's earned a permanent spot, not in my library, but on the small shelf that sits next to my desk. From this book, I learn more about the defense procurement process, the ineffectiveness of over-reliance on military technology, drones, counter-productive military policies, and even the inner workings of the military-industrial congressional complex than from any five books that I've read on subjects similar to this. This book is that good. And the book is Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. The author is Andrew Coburn, who is also the Washington editor of Harper's Magazine, and he joins us today. Andrew, welcome to the Tim Danahy Show.
Hey, Tim. Great to be with you.
Well, it's a delight to have you. I'm familiar with the work of some of your compatriots, and it's just remarkable things. But what I would like to do, if I may, Andrew, is I want to start the book, and I'm just going to read the last four sentences of the book, because it really sets the stage for this conversation. As one person promised, that with a more intense campaign, victory would come quickly. Enemy leaders switched off their cell phones and faded from view. Pentagon officials demanded more spending. Wall Street analysts hailed the prospect of sure bet paydays for drone builders and other weapons makers. The system rolled on autonomously, one big robot mowing the grass forever. That really does kind of describe how the military, industry, media, and financial players are involved, don't they?
Yeah, it does. I tried to sort of came to me at the last minute, sort of wrapped it all up. I mean, it was, you know, as you can tell, it, we're referring to there is the launch of the campaign against ISIS by President Obama last September. And it really, you know, I tried to put in, or I think it does put in all the elements. I mean, for example, people, when discussing, you know, drones and, you know, high-tech weapons and all the rest of it, and what's really going on, even people want to discuss the moral side of it, like, you know, maybe this is an immoral way to fight a war, always leave out the most important element, which is money. You know, this happens for money. And I, you know, as Wall Street analysts sort of said, as I quote, you know, their big response was, you know, this is going to be a big payday, a sure bet payday for drone builders like, you know, General Atomics and various other people. The other thing is that the forever quote I said at the end, I felt rather depressed at the end of doing all this, describing everything, because time and time again during the book, when it's shown that some system doesn't work or has an entirely counterproductive, you know, consequence, and some brave whistleblower or tester points out that, you know, things are going absolutely the wrong way, it makes no difference, because the whole machine of procurement and targeting and, you know, sort of the bureaucratic imperatives of, you know, whichever, you know, the CIA, the Air Force, you know, various military services, you know, that's so powerful that whether the thing, whatever the result is, kind of beside the point. And I felt I thought, oh my God, this is just one huge machine rolling on forever.
What's interesting about the big machine, Andrew, is that and I don't want to lose sight of the one sentence, and the enemies turned off their cell phones.
This, yes.
Even and that's a very subtle phrase whenever people listeners are not familiar with the context of it, and that line really indicates the ineffectiveness of the military technology, really at a number of levels, doesn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, because I point out as in the course of the book, you know, how much the whole system of targeting, of, you know, assassinating enemy leaders, of, you know, targeting drone missiles and other kind of missiles and munitions with what President Obama likes to call precise precision, really depends on cell phones. It depends on the enemy very obligingly, I mean, not in every case, but in majority of cases, very obligingly sort of carrying around, you know, a sensor that will guide the missile in, which is the cell phone. And, you know, it's once the enemy, you know, gets wise to this and doesn't carry a cell phone or, you know, switches it off, the system kind of grinds to a halt. Without getting too deep into it right now, I mean, I talk about in the book a lot about how this whole system of warfare depends on sensors. I mean, early in the book, I talk about how we place sensors in the jungle in Vietnam to pick up the sound of enemy supply columns coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which didn't work at all. But it was a hugely ambitious and expensive and profitable for various corporations undertaking. And, you know, as we move through time to the present age, now we have the enemy sort of obligingly buying the sensors himself and carrying them around, except the enemy has gotten wise to this, so that doesn't work either.
Well, if I don't want to bypass the story that you have in the book about Vietnam, because this military extravagance has a history. And your book really talks about this in Vietnam, and you mentioned sensors in the jungle, and you talk about how our government back then spent almost $2 billion to set it up and $1 billion a year to operate it. And then you quote and cite the actions of General Don C. Nguyen, you know to whom I'm referring, but they were mentioning how the Vietnamese would have cattle go down the Ho Chi Minh Trail to simulate the sound of soldiers marching or carry bags of urine. I mean, for all the billions that we spent, the technology was ineffective, and within a week, the Vietnamese were able to circumvent something that we thought would last for years, right?
Exactly right. I mean, that's what happened. The enemy, you know, that this, you know, as you say, huge, many billions of dollars had gone into setting this up, setting this whole thing up, and the enormous cost and effort. We showered thousands and thousands of sensors across the jungle, which sensors that could hear, sensors that could smell movement, sense movement, sensors that could smell urine, ammonia, and even other, even more esoteric varieties. And the idea was that these sensors would pick up the telltale sounds of, you know, enemy sounds of any marching feet or of trucks and the, you know, ground movements from people marching along or vehicles moving or the smell that people would leave from if they urinated. And that would all be sorted out, sent back to a huge computer in Thailand, which would sort it all out and figure out, you know, that this sound plus, you know, this movement means it's a North Vietnamese truck column and it's in this location heading this way. And the computer would then sort of basically send out the instructions, spit out the instructions for where to bomb. And they'd send out planes and drones to do it. The drones in those days really didn't work at all, didn't last long. But they, it was this whole idea. I told that story, because it was the first step, really major step in trying to automate the battlefield. But also this, it was not just automating it, it was this whole idea that we have a pattern. We can know what the enemy looks like. And once we identify, you know, the relevant pattern, then we can target it. And that's really a mindset that persists to this day. We know what a terrorist looks like. We know what a terrorist group looks like. And that's, you know, it's gotten now very esoteric, and they have all sorts of fancy algorithms for sort of looking, thinking what a sort of, you know, what an Al-Qaeda meeting looks like. And so you can go and, you know, destroy them with a drone missile, even if you don't know who they are, which is what happens most of the time.
Well, I want to get into that drone issue in just a little bit. But I want to just also just talk about the history. One more thing, and that would be the F-117 stealth fighter. And listeners may be familiar with it as being very angular. And we look at it as being, you know, a very expensive and very successful example of U.S. military technology, but you write in your book, and again, forgive me, Andrew, for reading a sentence or two to you you've written it. But you said only in 1996, when the General Accounting Office published the results of a diligent 3-year investigation, did light dawn on what actually happened. The F-117 had not flown unescorted and unafraid to its targets. It always needed the company of many escorting planes dedicated to jamming the enemy radars that supposedly could not see the Lockheed plane anyhow. And that just shows the further lunacy of all the money that has been invested into technology that didn't work, correct?
That's absolutely right. In fact, stealth, that's a very good example you picked there, because stealth was billed, it was really sort of sold by a very important character in both in my book and in the whole sort of sorry story of U.S. defense over the last 20 or 30 years, called William Perry, Dr. William Perry, who he's advised presidents and he's had major positions really going back to the Carter era. And Perry sold the whole idea of stealth, which we could make our planes invisible, and even we could make whole ships invisible to radar. And that has cost to date, I saw, you know, someone gave me an interesting figure the other day, probably $1 trillion. We probably spent $1 trillion on stealth, and it doesn't work. That example, which, you know, you just quoted, how, you know, at the time of the first Gulf War, the F-117 was billed as this magic plane, because it had been so pretty secret up till then, this magic plane, which we'd developed in secret that could fly into the heart of the enemy's defenses, and the enemy couldn't see it on his radar because it was this brilliant thing. And then, in fact, as it took the General Accounting Office, a very sober, you know, not given to wild speculation government institution, they'd done a very intense study, and they found, looking at all the actual records, that not only was it perfectly visible to certain kinds of radar, but the people, the pilots knew it, the people flying it knew that at the time, and they demanded jamming planes, and not just any jamming plane. They demanded the most advanced jamming planes the U.S. had to try and jam the enemy radar, which if the promises of public relations had been accurate, they wouldn't have needed. So it's a very striking example. $1 trillion, imagine that.
Well, you just use an operative phrase. You said, I believe, public relations on that, but the media reported the success because that what was fed to them by the military command. But there's a history that wasn't reported, and that's an equivalent history about how enemies shame the military technology. We cited the Vietnam, there was something with a Paul Van Piper that I was fascinated, and I wish time would allow me to read pages 133 to 136 of this book. But there was something called the Millennium Challenge 2000, and this was an internal military war game that cost $250 million. And if you would be so kind to talk about Paul Van Piper and the Millennium Challenge 2002.
Right. Well, as you say, what they in 2002, they organized under the auspices, really, of Donald Rumsfeld, was this giant war game, which was going to demonstrate, it was all set up to demonstrate how all these, the quintessential sort of philosophy of the military as it stood at that time, how well it worked, that they actually used drones. It was all going to be about precision warfare, about net-centric warfare, where you know, everything, all our side will be in perfect sort of harmony with each other through electronic communication, and how we would know, they had a thing called operational net assessment, a concept where we would know everything we needed to know about the enemy. So this was all set up, and it was part of it, you know, it wasn't just on computers, it wasn't just a sort of, you know, video game. They had actually, I think, 13 or 14,000 troops involved and ships and everything. And it was meant to be a war in the, you know, posited a war in the Persian Gulf. It was sort of against a sort of, really against a sort of ISIS-type character, actually, who was being played by Paul Van Riper, who was a Marine general, a retired Marine general, and he was playing the part of the enemy. And without taking up too much time, I can say that he sank the entire invading force just by using his brains, really. I mean, he, for example, when they attacked, they said, okay, we've wiped out all your, you know, fiber optic communications. You're going to have to communicate with your troops by radio, which they thought they could listen in on. Instead of that, he simply said, well, he had his orders issued by people calling from the mosques at prayer time. Or using motorbikes. So he completely nullified all the high-tech devices that were being shown off by the friendly side, it's called the Blue Force, defeated the invading force. So they said, oh, okay, we have to start again. Well, you're not allowed to do all these things, and, you know, they rigged the game, restarted it, so they could win. He quit in disgust. But, you know, there are some good characters in my book. I mean, good guy characters like General Von Riper and others who have taken a different approach. They realize it's the human beings that are important in war, not the high technology. And
Andrew, I want to get into that. We're going to have to take a break, and then when we come back, we'll kind of hone in on the these people and the subject of drones. And one of the people, I believe his name is Rivolo. We'll talk about him. Again, this book, Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins, is one of the best books I have written in a long time. These stories, the way you tell them, Andrew, are fascinating, and there are so many more in this book that it's a must-read if you care about government, if you care about military, if you care about budgets, if you care about justice, if you care about peace. Just a remarkable book, Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins, Andrew Coburn. You're listening to him here on The Tim Danny Show. We'll be right back.
We want a home to live in. We want a decent job. No predatory lenders and banks that steal and rob. No drones in Pakistan. No assassination plan.
A good man, real people, clear thinking, enjoyable, quality talk, a new name, EgbertoWillies.com. He talks politics, he talks issues, and you can hear his radio shows and read his blog at EgbertoWillies.com. You can link to him here at Danahy.com. He's also part of CoffeePartyUSA.com's network. Or, if you can spell EgbertoWillies.com, you found a new voice you'll want to hear. EgbertoWillies.com.
In Iraq, Iran, Congo, Afghanistan.
Our government should be open. It must be accountable to the people. And we demand access to vote and our votes be counted and verified. These concepts should be common sense in our democracy, but they're not. Some would deny us these rights. But people died for them, and Common Cause works every day to make certain they did not die in vain. Join Common Cause. Keep your rights and hold political power accountable where it should be. The people. CommonCause.org. Holding power accountable.
It's against the law to be a pacifist here in the USA. 'Cause the government says we're terrorists and takes our rights away. Yeah, the 99 are the enemy to Romney and Barack. Bill of Rights, civil liberties, they both are trying to sack.
Okay, you love books. You believe in your country and you want to be involved. but you're sick of the politics. So try this. Join the Coffee Party USA Book Club and share your thoughts and comments with readers across America. Here's how it works. The Coffee Party USA selects a book each month. Buy it from your local bookstore or online, and let us know you're going to be part of this book's discussion. Send us some of your thoughts and questions, and listen to Coffee Party USA Internet Radio. Hear the authors or a discussion about the book, and just be involved. It's that simple. So just click on the Coffee Party USA Book Club link here at Danahy.com, or join directly at coffeepartyusa.com/book_club_sign-up. Something's happening out there. People are getting involved. You should too. CoffeePartyUSA.com.
Yeah, the Dems and Republicans won't let us in debates. So the only ones at the podiums are corporate candidates. You see, truth spoken to power can only serve to illuminate.
Welcome back to the Tim Danahy Show here at Danahy.com, and we're talking with Andrew Coburn about his new book. He's an author, and he's also, I should make mention, a Washington editor of Harper's Magazine. And his new book is Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins, an extraordinary book. As I said earlier in the show, that one's going up with my favorite 20 by my desk. It's that good. And Andrew, when we left, we were talking about General Van Piper, or Riper, excuse me, and the Millennium Challenge 2000. And you mentioned that there were good people involved with this, and we'll talk about these people. But the key thing at this point of the conversation is that the military knew their technology wasn't working or could be counteracted inexpensively. And one of the best examples that I thought was the captured drone, the drone that was captured in Iran. And it was captured primarily by using a $29.95 piece of software that they had purchased from the internet. This is extraordinary, and it represents only one of the fallacies about the power of the drone. Correct?
Well, that's right. This was a super. The drone. It was a super secret at the time, sort of stealth drone that developed by the CIA, that was flying over Iran. And basically what the Iranians did, seems fairly clear, that all drones depend on GPS. It's really what GPS is what made drones possible for navigating them and for controlling them. So they fed in fake GPS signals. So basically, to put it almost oversimplified, but basically what happened was the drone, quote-unquote, thought that it was flying back to its base in Afghanistan, to Kandahar, where, in fact, the navigational information that the Iranians were feeding in was really guiding it to land at an Iranian airfield. So, you know, it was spoofed, but that's quite an easy thing to do. There's a professor at the University of Texas who has demonstrated this repeatedly. And yet, you know, we're never told that. It's one of the examples where we're told, oh, this is such esoteric technology, you never understand it, and you've got to give us another $1 billion to enhance it further. And in fact, it either doesn't work or can be easily defeated. I mean, not in every case, but, you know, I give, as you mentioned, I give a lot of examples of this sort of thing in the book.
There's something important about this too, Andrew. You know, for all the technology and how it can be circumvented by, in this case, the Iranians. You know, I read a book a couple years ago by a gentleman by the name of Jim Ferguson, and the drones are almost laughed at by the Taliban whenever they were first deployed in Afghanistan, because they said really the only difference that it made was that instead of having two people put down an IED, an explosive device, it would just take three. One guy to look up at the sky, and then whenever it fired a missile, they would see the jet pack fire light up, and then they would know to scatter. It was ridiculous. But
right.
But the drone is not that good. I mean, even the target resolution, your interpretive rating scale, I was stunned how bad the resolution is, but that's still the
well,
key
that's right.
Factor.
I mean, the most stunning thing, this is a few years ago, but it hasn't really changed that much, which is the drone for night work. It had a vision, visual acuity, I guess you call it, is of 20 over 200. And we've all heard of 20/20 vision. Well, this had 20/200 vision, which means you could see, well, basically what meant that is, by an interesting coincidence, the legal definition of blindness for most states in this, for drivers. I mean, if you've got 20/200 vision, you're not allowed to drive. And yet, you know, this is the visual capability of something we send out to spot the enemy and distinguish friend from foe and, you know, kill the foes. It's that bad. I mean, it's you know, in the first chapter of the book, I talk, you know, when I describe an actual drone strike from the, you know, because I have all the communications among the people, drone operators. At one point, one of the drone operators says, he complains. He says, I can never really tell if someone's, it's very hard to tell if someone's carrying a rifle or not, unless they're actually firing it, or they sort of sling it behind, you know, they move it around behind their back. Otherwise, you know, it looks like a shovel, or it could look like a shovel or something. And yet life and death decisions are taken on the basis of this kind of picture.
We're talking about the interpretive rating scale, and I was surprised whenever they were looking at the resolution from these drones, that it reminded me of Pac-Man, you know, like these little creatures that were chewing going around the screen, and the resolution is not much better than that. But there's actually a quantifiable rating with this interpretive rating scale, and it goes from 1 to 9, and a 9... the 1 is to be able to recognize that it's a super jetliner, and 9 is to recognize a human face. And then, and then what was the Predator's rating on that? If 1 is an airplane and 9 is a human face, what was the best?
Well, he could tell something was a vehicle, but couldn't tell what kind of vehicle it was. He couldn't tell the difference between, you know, what kind of tank it was. He could only see a very small patch of territory at a time. Everyone keeps saying the same thing. You know, it's like looking through a soda straw. The infrared camera, this is an official test by the Pentagon testing office. They could detect something versus nothing, but couldn't discern what that something was. If it was a tank, whether it was a tank or a truck, they could only do that like a fifth of the time. There's so many things wrong. And basically, I mean, the best example of how bad it can be is that the visual acuity, if you, sort of a lumpy phrase. Which means how well it can see. We've all heard of people having, you know, we know about 20/20 vision. Well, it had, for night work, it had 20 over 200 vision, 20/200 vision, which is by interesting coincidence, is the legal definition of blindness for drivers in most states in this country.
Well, and it has consequences to put the faith in this very expensive and poor technology, and that it puts our troops in danger. And you cited an example, a place called Thakur Gar, where if we had just used visual intelligence instead of drone intelligence, we could have saved some lives.
Exactly. I mean, it's a horrifying example where this was a battle in Afghanistan. It was part of a thing called Operation Anaconda in 2002. And what happened was there were some special forces troops trapped on top of a mountain against, they'd landed the drone sort of all, the video pictures that we looked at showed there were no enemy there. In fact, there was a very well-prepared and dug-in enemy. on top of this mountain. So they quickly ran into trouble and started taking casualties. There was an officer on the scene who understood exactly what was going on. He was right there, just at the bottom of the valley. But the headquarters, who were 1,000 miles away on an island in the middle of the Persian Gulf or off the coast of Oman, they had a drone picture. And they said, no, we're in charge. We can see exactly what's going on this drone picture, which was, according to someone who was, saw it, said it was like a sort of bluey-green blur, really. You couldn't see well at all, 20 over 200, remember. And they insisted on running the battle from there. So it's a very... So basically, 7 Americans died. I can't say whether they would have all lived had they been left it to the guy on the ground, but a lot of people believe, that they might well have, and certainly wouldn't have been as big a disaster as it turned out to be.
Well, I mentioned earlier about the laughability, really, of the ineffectiveness of drones. And, of course, this is a serious message. You know where I'm coming from with this, Andrew. There was a gentleman by the name of Rivolo who did the calculation of risk, and you said that apparently that there's so little fear of a drone that enemies are willing to install an IED along a roadside for as little as $15 because there really isn't that much danger involved with it.
That's right. He's like a very brilliant analyst called Rex Rivolo, as you say, who was attached to a very sort of secret little intelligence group attached to the part of the ground commander in Iraq's office in 2007. And Rex was interested to see, he was tasked to look at the IED war. In fact, that's what this group was meant to be doing, which was, the prime threat to our troops. And he found that for someone burying an IED, despite the billions of dollars we were spending on surveillance, but not just drones, but all sorts of surveillance devices meant to be spotting people planting IEDs, that there was basically no risk. He did a calculation of the number of people who've been spotted or killed planting IEDs versus the number of IEDs, and it turned out to be 0.06% were actually spotted. So basically he said that, that's why they'll do it for $15, because it's completely risk-free. You just go out and dig a hole in the road and stick the thing in. So he, and yet, because there was so much money involved, so much people were making so much money and having their, if they were in the military, their bureaucratic empires sort of expanded, no one was paying attention to this. They were carrying on regardless. And meanwhile, thousands of American servicemen and women were being killed or being horribly wounded. It was a huge thing. And maybe we can talk more about what Rex and the other things Rex discovered.
Well, what I need to do, we're kind of getting close to the end of the show, but I want to mention that really, despite all the billions and all the media praise of drones from information fed by the military-industrial complex, the perpetuation of this by the Congress and their approaches, the drones, besides being ineffective, are really counterproductive. It's the collateral damage, and it's making enemies out of our friends, isn't it?
Well, that's right. In Yemen or in Pakistan, places we've used it, it's, it does have a very, people, although, there's lots of violence in those places anyway, from things other than the drones, but people hate the drones. It's something about this impersonal nature, that this thing is hovering and you can hear them, in that relevant parts of Pakistan and Yemen, you can hear that sort of buzzing. It's like all the time. It sort of drives you crazy, actually. And the fact that they claim to be precise, but yet everyone knows people, innocent civilians, friends, relatives, or neighbors who've been killed by them or been, injured by them. So it has a huge knock-on effect. And in fact, the rather macabre, another example I heard recently, which was in Somalia, the Shabab, who are the sort of jihadist group who are fighting there, Islamic extremists, because we are, attacking them with drones and we keep announcing we've killed another, one or other important leader, that's actually enhanced their prestige. They say, if the Americans are really going, using their most advanced weapons to go after the Shabab, they must be really serious guys. You know, I think I might join up with them. I'm going to support them. It's had that effect, which was, you know, that's talk about an unintended consequence, but it's there.
Well, it happened in Afghanistan, too. Your book mentions how, you know, we really didn't have any targets. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda had gone into hiding and into Pakistan, but yet Petraeus, I believe, wanted to have numbers of people killed. So the warlords were just turning in people with barking dogs
exactly.
or whatever, and we were sending them to Guantanamo and attacking them with drones. And these were not quality targets.
Right. And in fact, it was worse than that because we, you know, we were so keen, we're so fixated on this idea of the high-value target. You know, if we take out the high-value targets, then, you know, that's the way, the route to victory. And that's been our strategy really all along, and is today. High-value targets meaning enemy leaders. So when we got to Afghanistan, I mean, the Taliban had melted away, had given up or gone to Pakistan and had packed it in, but we wanted high-value targets. So as you said, you know, we had warlords or, you know, anyone who wanted to get rid of someone simply went to the Americans and said, hey, he's a Taliban leader or an Al-Qaeda person. And we obliged them to then scoop them up and take them off to a Guantanamo or kill them or drone them or whatever. So so that's what got people so annoyed, so riled up, that really led to the rebirth of the Taliban in Afghanistan, which has, you know, then led to years and years of war.
Well, this book, Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins, has not only these stories, but many, many other stories. It is one of the best books I have read in recent years. I would encourage you to get it, read it, then start asking the questions, because we do have to hold people accountable for this kind of military-industrial insanity. And Andrew Coburn, I want to thank you so much for coming on the Tim Danny Show. It's been an honor to talk with you, and I'm hoping that we can get you back on as time and schedules allow.
Anytime. Tim, it's been great. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Hundreds of lives of the 1%, and that might change the state.
Tim Danahy Show would like to thank Aaron Taylor of SRC Labs for IT strategy, social media support, and event management. Prasanas, a leading designer and manufacturer of audio recording software, hardware, and related accessories available at Guitar Center. For Edward Danahy for post-production assistance. And Theodore, the studio dog, for his quiet companionship.
Your democracy takes integrity, and if you want it back, don't throw your voice away on Romney and Barack. So when it's time to vote this year, if you're not sitting in some jail, don't vote for the 1% and let the 99 prevail. Don't vote for the 1% and let the 99 prevail.